Recently deemed as one of the decade's most gifted up-and-coming modern classical composers, Sarah Kirkland Snyder's compositions draw from a variety of inspirations, from Mozart and Chopin, Orville Peart and David Lang, to Radiohead and St. Vincent. Sarah's orchestral, chamber, and choral works are critically acclaimed, as are her song cycles, which really fuse together her love for both classical and rock influences. Sarah will present her newest song cycle, Unremembered, at this year's Big Ears Festival, tonight at 8:30 at the Bijou Theater. Joining her are the Knights Ensemble and vocalists Shara Nova, D.M. Stith, and Padma Newsom. Sarah and I spoke on the phone a few days ago while she was still at her home in New Jersey. Sarah Kirkland Snyder, it is a great pleasure to talk with you today. Thanks so much for taking time to chat.
Sure, thanks for having me.
You are presenting your new song cycle, Unremembered, at this year's Big Ears Festival. I believe the album was released in September?
Yes, September 2015.
How did this piece come about? It started out as a commission from the vocal ensemble Roomful of Teeth.
Yeah, they asked me to just write a short set of songs, and so I asked my friend Nathaniel, who is a writer and poet whose work I really had admired for a while, to write me some text for that commission. So he sent me 5 poems, I believe it was, and I wrote those songs, and it was a quick summer project that we had to do in 2 weeks, and as soon as the 2 weeks wrapped, he sent me an email with an attachment of 25 more poems and 25 illustrations that also went with each poem.
Wow.
And he said, you know, you don't have to do anything with these. I just wanted to share it with you. These mm-hmm. also came out. And I just loved them. And there was this whole world inside of them that I really wanted to explore. So I decided to expand the project into something larger.
Yeah, the illustrations are really beautiful. We got a copy of the CD here at the station. And I was surprised by, I didn't know that there were accompanying illustrations and artwork,
yeah.
really, and definitely a pleasant surprise. I imagine it was a pleasant surprise for you as well.
Oh, yeah, because each one, since you've seen them, you know, they're really complex.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost
yeah.
like stained glass where you have a series of layered narratives in each illustration. So there would be different parts of the poems that he would unpack visually. Yeah, I spent a long time just sitting there turning these illustrations around from side to side, and I was so taken in by them and, yeah, just really compelled and inspired. I actually heard music in many cases right away when I was looking at them. So they became a really essential part of the project, and I'm excited that we'll be able to project them during the concerts.
So,
yeah.
Did that change your method or your process for composing at all?
I mean, it did in as much as, I mean, I've never really used visual art as an inspiration before. This was the first time that I'd really spent time looking at artwork and then taking a walk and thinking about the ideas that artwork directly brought to mind. And in some cases, the illustrations also helped explain something about the poem that I hadn't necessarily been aware of. So it really was an essential part of the process for me. And then Nathaniel and I spent a lot of time talking about the illustrations as well and the poems. So it really gave me the opportunity to go deeper into the material.
The poetry is complex and it's deep, but could you summarize sort of essentially what the cycle is about?
Yeah, sure. It's a series of vignettes of memories from Nathaniel's childhood. He grew up on a farm in rural Massachusetts near Salem, where the witch trials were. And he created the series of vignettes, which are memories both real and imagined from his childhood. He spent a lot of time alone walking through the woods, and at times he would encounter animals that talked or mm-hmm. ghosts in a barn next door. He encountered a man in a pond and another man immersed in flames. And so those experiences were fantastical, but there are other stories which were real.
Mm-hmm.
And even the ones that were fantastical were sort of symbols for other things that he was dealing with at the time. So essentially, it's this collection of memories that deal with innocence and ruin, the idea of innocence and experience and the journey to adulthood, how our memory changes, how our sense of nostalgia for a place changes, and particularly, I think, the ways that nostalgia can register almost as a kind of Stockholm syndrome, when you have both fear and love and dread and gratitude all wrapped up together when you're thinking of a place that had an important role in your past.
Mm-hmm. You're a mother. Composing this work and thinking of it from the point of view of the strange time of your life that is childhood, did being a mother influence how you saw this work, how you composed the music?
Being a mother definitely affected my, you know, attraction to this material.
Yeah.
and my perspective on writing it, because I'm sort of resubmerged into the world of childhood, as any mother is,
yeah.
And you see the world again through the eyes of your children and the ways that everything, all of their emotions are so outsized and larger than life, and they have so much wonder and amazement at the world and a sense of mystery and mm-hmm. anxiety. All of that is so pronounced, and I'm constantly aware of that as a mother, and it's great because it puts you back in touch with the feelings you had as a child. So I think definitely that affected my writing of this cycle.
The scoring is for a full orchestra?
On the album, it's a chamber orchestra.
Okay.
And there is an arrangement for that, but for Big Ears, we're doing an octet arrangement.
Okay.
So it's oboe, English horn, percussion, piano, harp, violin, cello, and electronics. So there's three vocalists covering seven vocal parts, but I reduced the orchestra to these eight instruments.
Who are the musicians? Is this an organized group that normally plays together?
Yeah, it's a group called The Knights.
Okay.
They're a really fantastic chamber ensemble in New York. They have a sort of flexible instrumentation. They do large projects, they do small projects, but what's sort of at the forefront of what makes them special is their ability to play any kind of musical language and really understand and inhabit it well. And this piece, Unremembered, as you know, it draws on both classical and non-classical music.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really important to me to have a group who understood that and felt comfortable working in a language that incorporated inflections of indie rock and pop and folk music.
And the vocalists are?
The vocalists are Shara Nova, formerly Shara Warden. She's a fantastic, classically trained singer-songwriter who mostly operates as My Brightest Diamond. And then there's also D.M. Stith, who's also a classically trained singer-songwriter. And Padma Newsom, who is also a classically trained singer-songwriter as well as composer. So it's three singers who themselves sort of hover in the in-between space between classical and folk or classical and indie rock.
I'm personally not a big fan of labeling music, putting it into a box and calling it a specific genre. And that's one of the aspects that I love about your music, is that it's genre-defying. Yet there are those attempts to label it. I've heard it called chamber pop and indie classical. What do you think about these labels, and do you think they describe your music?
You know, I sort of tend to feel the same way that you do. I don't really like labels at all, and when I'm composing, I'm definitely not thinking about that. In fact, I try really hard not to think about those kind of concerns, but I understand, you know, from the other perspective, why it's helpful to have certain signifiers in order to let, you know, potential audience know what they're in for or interest potential new listeners. In my role as a co-director of the record label New Amsterdam, I do understand how, you know, writers and people who are talking about the music need to be able to talk about it, and sometimes those shorthand labels can be helpful. The only problem is when they inadvertently turn away a listener who might, you know, where the music is just more complicated than, say, a label like chamber pop describes, or indie classical makes somebody think of post-minimalism and they don't like post-minimalism, or whatever it is, because every composer obviously has their own voice and there are wide varieties of music that can be housed under the indie classical umbrella. And so it's sort of, I guess it's a necessary evil having these shorthands, but I do get frustrated often by the labels, and I really go out of my way not to think about that when I'm writing. You know, it's the same problem actually with reading reviews in a certain way, where if somebody even compliments you for something, then the next time you're writing, you want to do that thing again to get that compliment again.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too much self-consciousness instead of just thinking about what the piece wants to be.
So it sounds like it wasn't intentional for you to sort of combine these classical and pop styles together. It just kind of happened? It's your style?
Well, this is a really good question because, you know, why is this piece more poppy than some of my orchestral music or my chamber music? I think it does have to do with who's commissioning the piece, and invariably the institution or ensemble that commissions a piece winds up influencing, I think, the way that you're thinking about the music. You want to write something that will flatter them or that will work for these forces and will work with their values as an institution. And in this case, the first five songs were commissioned by Roomful of Teeth, but then the following eight songs were sort of loosely commissioned by the Ecstatic Music Festival, which is it's a music festival in New York, and the whole point of the festival is to encourage cross-pollination between different genres.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also something that we talk about a lot at New Amsterdam. That's sort of the mission of our label. But honestly, the reason why that commission even came about is because when I got these poems, there was something about them that just felt like they wanted to speak in a language that wasn't just classical, that somehow incorporated other influences.
To me, it seems like this fusing of styles is becoming more and more acceptable. People seem to be more accepting of music that defies a label. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I definitely would agree with that. I think that the broader music listening public has always been very open, but I think that the classical world is opening a bit, and I think it's realizing that people are quite open to different influences in classical music, and not only open to it and enjoy it, and I think that composers are really enjoying that because there's so much more freedom now that they feel in the ways that they can express themselves. I mean, from our experience at New Amsterdam, when we founded the label in 2007, the critical and the consumer response was astounding. Our records were selling really well, and these composers were getting a lot of commissions from these records, and critics were writing really nice things, and it just seemed like, wow, there's a hunger out there for music like this. I just think people's ears are more open than we tend to even give them credit for.
Much of your graduate studies were focused on sort of this intellectual approach to composing music, rules and history, and not really on the emotional component of writing music, which just kind of baffles me because to me, that's why music exists. It exists to make us feel.
Exactly. I mean, I couldn't agree more. Like, to me, talking about music without talking about emotion is like talking about ceramics without talking about clay, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how do you do that? But then, in my experience anyway, we really didn't talk about emotion, and conversation was very much limited to technique and craft and things that are more easily quantifiable and that have the illusion of objectivity, you know, right and wrong. And I really craved more of the other kind of discussion, you know, the ineffability of music, like what makes this piece give you this sensation, and what piece makes you feel this way, and how does that work? Why is it so moving when this chord comes in? Or, you know, there is no objective answer there, but I think that the discussion is really important for developing a composer's thought process. And that was something that my peers and I did a lot together. And, you know, we didn't do it with our teachers so much, but that was something that, you know, I talked about a lot with my composer friends. And I do think that's changing, too. I think, you know, that as my generation comes up and becomes the main generation that's teaching composition, those strictures are getting relaxed. I mean, I think even, honestly, in the last 10 years, a lot has changed. I think there's just been a really big shift, you know, that you see both in programming and in the academy, where there's just a lot more open-mindedness.
Which composers, bands, and musicians are your greatest influences?
My first love as a child was Mozart, and then I fell madly in love with Chopin and Debussy. And so I feel like those three loom large in my musical DNA or the way that I was programmed to think about music. I have a hard time getting away from sort of regular phrasing in my music, and I think that really comes from the amount of Mozart that I was instructed to play as a child. But, you know, as I got older, I discovered, you know, of course, tons of other composers whose music I really admired. You know, everyone from Ligeti to John Adams to Arvo Pärt, Meredith Monk. There are many composers whose works I really admired, but I did always keep listening to a lot of bands at the same time, too. I mean, growing up, I played a lot of classical music, but my parents only played rock and pop at home. So I grew up hearing, you know, the Beatles and Fleetwood Mac and Simon and Garfunkel and Elton John. And then when I got into high school, I got really into alternative bands and the Smiths and the Stone Roses and Jesus and Mary Chain and R.E.M. and whatever, all that 80s stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was like P.J. Harvey and Slater Kinney. But, you know, who was always a strong influence was Joni Mitchell.
Mm.
I think when I was first composing, my music sounded kind of like a cross between Joni Mitchell and early Debussy,
mm-hmm.
like baby Debussy. So for me, it was always these two streams. And I think that's probably why I feel so at home writing music that brings those two streams together. Because, to be honest, I always felt a little bit divided down the middle, feeling like, where's the world in between that brings these things together?
Mm-hmm. I kind of hate to ask this because I'm sure you get asked this question all the time. In some ways, by asking it, I feel like I'm kind of perpetuating its existence. But I think it's something very important to talk about. What challenges have you encountered as a female composer, if any?
I think it is a really important question, actually. I mean, I know a lot of female composers don't like to talk about it, but I actually do like to talk about it because I think it's the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
There have been many instances of overt sexism that I've encountered and subtle sexism, and it's been a challenge, and it's been a discouragement. When I first entered the world of professional composing, I'd had enough negative experiences that were caused by sexism, ultimately,
mm-hmm.
that I really developed a distaste for the classical scene, the classical world. And mm-hmm. I just felt like, you know, all of this music that I'd grown up loving so deeply, you know, and I felt like music was my first language in a lot of ways. It was the place that I felt the most at home in the world and where I felt like the world made sense. It was just my refuge and sanctuary. And I had so many negative experiences that made me feel like, wow, you know, all of these composers whose works I loved so deeply, they probably would have been just as dismissive of me because I was a woman back then. You know,
mm-hmm.
like Chopin and Bach and Mozart and my idols, you know, the world is such a patriarchal and misogynistic place, to be quite honest. So I felt this sense of resentment of it for a while, and I didn't want to have anything to do with it for a little while. And honestly, a lot of that feeling I put into my first song cycle, Penelope, and I think it was in part responsible for my turning towards popular influences
mm-hmm.
in my writing, because I felt like the world of pop music had at least, it felt like it was equally owned by women, even though that's totally debatable and messed up a history as well.
Yeah.
It felt more like there was more female ownership in it than in the world of classical music. It took me some time to realize that in order to change that and make it better, I had to get over these feelings of resentment. Just to give you one recent example, like I was just in Holland. We were doing a tour with Crosslinks in Holland, and one of the instrumentalists came up to me after a rehearsal and was like, "Did you write this music all by yourself?" But that's like, that kind of thing happens all the time to female composers. There's this idea of like, you can't possibly have done this by yourself. You know, who did your electronics? Who did your orchestration? And it'll be from these well-intentioned and even sometimes like young people, like the guy who asked me that was in his 30s. And those are the moments where you just feel so discouraged and feel like, God, if people are in their 30s and still have attitudes like that, like, we do have such a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my experiences on this planet as a woman, so I feel like for me, I really want to bring out the core of my female experience in the music that I write, because that is me being honest, is me speaking from the point of view of my feelings and experiences, and all of those are as a woman. I had a teacher, just really quickly, who told me when I was in my 20s, he said, because you're a woman, you know, you're going to have to write music that's less melodic and less lyrical because you're a woman, because when a man writes melody, it's courageous and he's making himself vulnerable, and that's a good thing. When a woman writes melody and makes herself vulnerable, it's being indulgent and sentimental.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, you'll win more competitions and do better and get more letters of recommendation if you try to make your music a little less direct emotionally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's truth to that. And he wasn't himself, I never got the feeling that he was sexist. He was just trying to advise me in a world that he saw as being really sexist.
But then what happens if you go too far in the other direction? Like if your music is too masculine in some way?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question. I had another teacher who said, you know, the most successful female composers are the ones who write really masculine music. And I still don't really know what he meant, because he was listing people like Meredith Monk, who, frankly, I don't hear her music as being masculine. But I think there's this tendency to see success in music as a masculine thing. And so some people will associate a certain kind of music with being masculine just because it's gotten some recognition. It's this whole weird, it's complicated, and
yeah.
Really it's something that I spend a lot of time thinking about and wishing were not the case, because it's hard to feel like there are people out there who won't give you the credit you deserve for your work because of your gender, you know,
mm-hmm.
Or it's hard to think that maybe a certain piece of music would get more performances or win a larger audience if you were a guy.
Composer Sarah Kirkland-Snyder, it's been wonderful talking with you. Thanks so much, and safe travels to Knoxville.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking with you, Melanie. Thanks for having me.
Composer Sarah Kirkland-Snyder, who is performing her song cycle Unremembered at this year's Big Ears Festival, which kicks off tonight. More information and a complete schedule can be found online at bigearsfestival.com.